If they were, he would at least be spared the indignity of going through the pockets of Intragian's victims. Or maybe he had been Josephson when he had done this, not that it mattered. All he'd have to do would be unhook the ore carrier, run up the garage door, and ride away. When you start smelling tack on your skin. Maybe he would smell it to start with, but he wouldn't smell it for long. David Carver might be a prophet, but he was a young prophet, and there were a few things he didn't seem to realize, direct line to God or no. One was the simple fact that stink washed off. Yes, indeed it did. That was one of the few things in life Johnny was entirely sure of. And the key to the ATV was, praise God, in the ignition. He leaned in, turned the key to accessory, and observed there was also more than 3/4 of a tank of gas. All sevens, baby, he said, and laughed. Rolling all sevens now. He went to the back of the little jeep-like vehicle and examined the ore cart coupling. No problem there, either. Just a glorified cotter pin was all it was. He'd find a hammer, knock it out. Not even Houdini could have done it, Marinville. It was the old Rum-Dum's voice this time. Because of the head. And what about the phone? What about the sardines? What about them? There were just a few more cans in the bag than we thought, that's all. He was sweating, though. Sweating the way he had in Nam, sometimes. It wasn't the heat, although it had been hot. And it hadn't been the fear, although you were afraid, even when you were sleeping. Mostly, it had been the sick sweat that came with knowing you were in the wrong place, at the wrong time, with fundamentally good people who were spoiling themselves, maybe forever, by doing the wrong thing. Unobtrusive miracles, he thought. Only once again he heard the words in the old Rum-Dum's voice. He was, by God, chattier dead than alive. Why, if it wasn't for the boy, you'd still be in a jail cell now, wouldn't you? Or dead. Or worse. And you deserted him. If I hadn't distracted that coyote with my jacket, David'd be dead now, Johnny said. Leave me alone, you old fool. He spotted a hammer lying on a work table against the wall. He headed in that direction. Tell me something, Johnny, Terry said, and he froze in his tracks. When exactly was it that you decided to deal with your fear of dying by giving up real life completely? That voice wasn't in his head. He was all but sure of it. Hell, he was sure of it. It was Terry, hanging on the wall, not a look-alike, not a mirage or a hallucination, but Terry. If he turned around now, he would see her with her head raised, her cheek no longer on her shoulder, looking at him as she had always looked at him when he fucked up. Patient, because Johnny Marinville fucking up was the usual course of things. Disillusioned, because she was the only one who kept expecting him to do better. Which was dumb, like betting on the Tampa Bay Bucks to win the Super Bowl. Except sometimes, with her, for her, he had done better, had risen above what he had come to think of as his nature. But when he did, when he excelled, when he fucking flew over the landscape, did she ever say anything then? Well, maybe, change the channel, let's see what's on PBS. But that was about the extent of it. You didn't even give up living for writing, she said. That would at least have been understandable if contemptible. You gave up living for talking about writing. I mean, Jesus, Johnny. He stalked to the table on trembling legs, meaning to throw the hammer at the bitch, see if that would shut her up. And that was when he heard the low growling from his left. He turned his head in that direction and saw a timber wolf, very likely the same one that had approached Steve and Cynthia with the canta in its mouth, standing in the doorway leading back to the offices. Its eyes glowed at him. For a moment it hesitated, and Johnny allowed himself to hope. Maybe it was afraid, maybe it would back off. Then it was running at him, full tilt, its muzzle wrinkling back to expose its teeth. 2. The thing which had been Ellen had been concentrating on the wolf, using the wolf to finish with the writer, so deeply that it was in a state akin to hypnosis. Now something, some disruption in the expected flow of things, interrupted Tack's concentration. It pulled back for a moment, holding the wolf where it was, but turning toward the rider truck with the rest of its terrible curiosity and dark regard. Something had happened at the truck, but Tack was unable to tell what it was. There was a feeling of disorientation, a sense of waking in a room where the positions of all the furniture had been subtly altered. Perhaps, if it wasn't trying to be in two places at the same time... "Me him, en to," it growled, and sent the wolf at the rider. So much for the man who would be Steinbeck. The thing on four legs was fast and strong, the thing on two, slow and weak. Tack pulled its mind out of the wolf, its vision of Johnny Merrinville first dimming, then fading out as the rider turned, groping for something on the work table with one hand while his eyes went wide with fright. It turned its full mind toward the truck and the others, although the only one of the others who mattered, who had ever mattered, would that it had understood earlier, was the shitting prey boy. The bright yellow rental truck was still parked on the street. Through the overlapping eyes of the spiders and with the low-to-the-ground heat vision of the snakes, Tack saw it clearly. But when it tried to go inside, it was unable. No eyes in there? Not even one tiny scuttering spider? No? Or was it Prey Boy again, blocking its vision? No matter. It didn't have time to let it matter. They were in there, all of them. They had to be. And Tack would have to leave it at that, because something else was wrong as well, something even closer to home. Something wrong with Mary. Feeling strangely and uncomfortably harried, feeling driven, it let the rider truck fade and now centered on the field office, looking through the uneasily shifting eyes of the creatures which filled it. It registered the out-of-place dryer first, then the fact that Mary was gone. She'd gotten out somehow. "You bitch!" it screamed, and blood flew out of Ellen's mouth in a fine spray. The word wasn't good enough to express its feelings, and so it lapsed into the old language, spitting invective as it got to its feet, and staggered for balance on the edge of the innie. The weakness of this body had advanced in a way that was appalling. What made it worse was that it didn't have a body to which it could immediately go if necessary. For the time being, it was stuck with this one. It thought briefly of the animals, but there were none here capable of serving Tack in that way. Tack's presence drubbed even the strongest of its human vessels to death in a matter of days. A snake, coyote, rat, or buzzard would simply explode immediately upon or moments after Tack's entry, like a tin can into which someone drops a lit stick of dynamite. The timber wolf might serve for an hour or two, but the wolf was the only one of its kind left in these parts, and currently 3 miles away, dealing with, and by now probably dining on, the writer. It had to be the woman. It had to be Mary. The thing that looked like Ellen slipped out through the rift in the wall of the Antac and limped toward the faint purple square that marked the place where the old shaft now opened into the outside world. Rats squeaked eagerly around Ellen's feet as it went, smelling the blood flowing out of Ellen's stupid, sickly cunt. Tack kicked them aside, cursing them in the old language. At the entrance to the China shaft it paused, looking down. The moon had passed behind the far side of the pit, but it still shed some light, and the dome light inside the police cruiser shed a little more. Enough for Ellen's eyes to see that the cruiser's hood was up, and for the creature now inhabiting Ellen's brain to understand that the sly Oz Pa had fucked the motor up somehow. How had she gotten out of the field office? And how had she dared to do this? How had she dared? For the first time, Tack was afraid. It looked left and saw that both pickups were standing on flats. It was like the Carver's RV all over again, only this time it was on the receiving end, and it didn't like the feeling one bit. That left the heavy equipment, and although it knew where the keys were, sets for everything in one of the field office file cabinets, they would do it no good. There was nothing down there it could drive. Carrie Ripton had known how to run the heavy stuff, but Tack had lost Ripton's physical skills the moment it left him for Josephson. As Alan Carver, it had some of Ripton's, Josephson's, and Entragian's memories, although even these were now fading like overexposed photographs, but none of their abilities. Oh, the bitch! Oz Pa! Can Finn! Clenching and unclenching Ellen's fists nervously, aware of her sodden panties and the soaked shirt inside them, aware that Ellen's thighs were painted with blood, Tack closed Ellen's eyes and looked for Mary. Me him en toe! En toe! En toe! At first there was nothing, just blackness and the slow flux of cramps deep down in Ellen's stomach. And terror. Terror that the Oz Pa bitch was gone already. Then it saw what it was looking for, not with Ellen's eyes, but with ears inside of Ellen's ears, a sudden alien echo of sound that made the shape of a woman. It was a circling bat that had seen Mary as she struggled up the road toward the northern rim of the pit, and Mary was a long way from fresh, gasping for breath and turning around every dozen steps or so, checking for pursuit. The bat saw the smells coming off her quite clearly, and what Tack picked up was encouraging. It was the smell of fear, mostly, the sort which might tilt into panic with one hard push. Still, Mary was only 400 yards or so from the top, and after that the going would be downhill. And while Mary was tired and breathing hard, the bat did not sense the bitter metallic aroma of exhaustion in the sweat which surrounded her. Not yet, at least. There was also the fact that Mary was not bleeding like a stuck pig. This next-to-useless Ellen Carver body was. The bleeding wasn't out of control, not yet, but would be before much longer. Perhaps taking time to collect itself, to rest in the comforting glow of the innie, had been a mistake, but who would have believed this could happen? What about sending the canned toy to stop her? Those that were not on the perimeter as part of the me-him. It could, but what fucking good would it do? It could surround Mary with snakes and spiders, with hissing wildcats and laughing coyotes, and the bitch would very likely walk right through them, parting them the way Moses had supposedly parted the Red Sea. She must know that Ellen couldn't damage her body, not with the canned toy, not with any other weapon. If she didn't know it, she'd still be in the field office, probably crouched in the corner, all but catatonic with fear, unable to make a sound after screaming herself hoarse. How had she known? Had it been the Prey Boy? Or had it been a message from the Prey Boy's god, David Carver's Cantac? No matter. The fact that Ellen's body was starting to come apart, and Mary had half a mile head start, those things didn't matter either. "I'm coming just the same, sweetheart," it whispered, and began making its way along one of the benches, moving away from the mine shaft and toward the road. Yes, coming just the same. It might have to beat this body to flinders in order to catch up with the Oz Pa, but it would catch up. Ellen turned her head, spat blood, grinned. She no longer looked much like the woman who had been considering a run for the school board, the woman who had enjoyed lunch with her friends at China Happiness, the woman whose deepest, darkest sexual fantasies had involved making love to the hunk in the Diet Coke commercials. "It doesn't matter how fast you hurry, Oz Pa. You're not getting away." 3. The dark shape dive-bombed her again, and Mary swatted it away. "Fuck off!" she panted at it. The bat veered, cheeping, but didn't go far. It circled her like some sort of spotter plane, and Mary had an unpleasant idea that that was just what it was. She looked up and saw the rim of the pit ahead and above her. Closer now, maybe only 200 yards, but it still looked mockingly far off. It felt as if she were tearing each breath out of the air, and it hurt going down. Her heart was hammering, and there was a deep stitch in her left side. She had actually thought she was in pretty good shape for a woman who was 30-something, as if using the Nordic track and the Stairmaster 3 times a week at Gold's Gym could get you ready for something like this. Suddenly, the fine gravel surface of the road slid out from under her sneakers, and her trembling legs weren't able to correct her balance in time. She was able to avoid going flat on her face by dropping to one knee, but her jeans tore. She felt the sting of the gravel biting through her skin, and then warm blood was flowing down her lower leg. The bat was on her at once, cheeping and battering its wings in her hair. "Get out, you cocksucker!" she cried, and boxed a closed fist at it. It was a lucky punch. She felt the fine-grained surface of one wing give way under the blow, and then the bat was fluttering on the road ahead of her, mouth opening and closing, staring at her, or seeming to, with its useless little eyes. Mary struggled to her feet and stamped on it, voicing a sharp, almost bird-like cry of satisfaction as it crunched beneath her sneaker. She started to turn again, then glimpsed something down below, a shadow moving among shadows. "Mary?" It was Ellen Carver's voice that came floating up, but at the same time, it wasn't. It was gargly, full. If you hadn't been through the hell of the last 6 or 8 hours, you might have thought it was Ellen with a bad cold. "Wait, Mare. I want to go with you. I want to see David. We'll go see him together." "Go to hell," Mary whispered. She turned and began to walk again, tearing breath out of the air and rubbing at the pain in her side. She would have run if she could. "Mary, Mary, quite contrary." Not quite laughing, but almost. "You can't get away, dear. Don't you know that?" The rim looked so far away that Mary forced herself to quit looking at it and lowered her head to her sneakers. The next time the voice behind her called her name, it sounded closer. Mary made herself walk a little faster. She fell twice more before she got to the rim, the second time hard enough to knock the wind out of her, and it took her precious, precious seconds of first kneeling and then standing, with her head down and her hands on her thighs, to get it back. She wished Ellen would call again, but she didn't. And now Mary didn't want to look back. She was too afraid of what she might see. 5 yards from the top, however, she finally did. Ellen was less than 20 yards below her, panting soundlessly through a mouth dropped so wide open that it looked like an air scoop. Blood misted out with each exhalation. Her blouse was drenched with it. She saw Mary looking at her, grimaced, reached out with clawed hands, tried to sprint forward and grab her. She couldn't. Mary, however, found that she could sprint. It was mostly the look in Ellen Carver's eyes. Nothing human in them. Nothing at all. She reached the top of the pit, the air now screaming thinly in and out of her throat. The road ran flat across 30 yards of rim, then tilted down. She could see a tiny yellow spark in the blackness of the desert floor, winking on and off, the blinker in the center of town. Mary set her eyes on this and ran a little faster. 4. "What are you doing, David?" Ralph asked tightly. After a short period of concentration, which was probably silent prayer, David had begun walking toward the back door of the Ryder truck. Ralph had moved instinctively, putting his body between his son and the handle that ran the door up. Steve saw this and sympathized with the feeling behind it, but didn't guess it would do much good. If David decided he was going to leave, David would leave. The boy held up the wallet. "Taking this back." "No, you don't," Ralph said, shaking his head rapidly. "No way. For God's sake, David, you don't even know where that man is. Out of town by now is my guess, and good riddance to bad rubbish." "I know where he is," David said calmly. "I can find him. He's close." He hesitated, then added, "I'm supposed to find him." "David?" To his own ears, Steve's voice sounded tentative, oddly young. "You said the chain was broken." "That was before I saw the picture in his wallet. I have to go to him. I have to go now. It's the only chance we have." "I don't understand," Ralph said, but he stepped away from the door. "What does that picture mean?" "There's no time, Dad. I'm not sure I could explain, even if there was." "Are we coming with you?" Cynthia asked. "We're not, are we?" David shook his head. "I'll come back if I can. With Johnny, if I can." "This is nuts," his father said, but he spoke hollowly, with no strength. "If you go wandering around out there, you'll be eaten alive." "No more than the coyote ate me alive when I got out of the cell," David said. "The danger isn't if I go out there. It's if we all stay in here." He looked at Steve, then at the rear door of the Ryder truck. Steve nodded and ran the door up on its tracks. The desert night slipped in, pressed against his face like a cold kiss. David went to his father and began to hug him. As Ralph's arms went around the boy in response, David felt that enormous force grab him again. It ran through him like hard rain. He jerked convulsively in his father's arms, gasping, then took a blind step backward. His hands, shaking wildly, were held out before him. "David!" Ralph cried. "David, what?" And it was over. As quickly as that, the force left, but he could still see the China pit, as he had seen it for a moment in the circle of his father's arms. It had been like looking down from a low-flying plane. It glimmered in the last of the moonlight, a wretched alabaster sinkhole. He could hear the ruffle of the wind in his ears and a voice. "Me him, en toe. Me him, en toe." Calling. A voice that wasn't human. He made an effort to clear his mind and looked around at them. So few left now. So few of the Collie and Tragian Survival Society. Steve and Cynthia standing together, his father bending down toward him. Behind them, the moon-drenched night. "What is it?" Ralph asked unsteadily. "Christ almighty, what now?" He saw he had dropped the wallet and bent to pick it up. Wouldn't do to leave it here, gosh, no. He thought of putting it into his own back pocket, then thought of how it had fallen out of Johnny's and dumped it down the front of his shirt instead. "You have to go to the pit," he told his father. "Daddy, you and Steve and Cynthia have to go out to the China pit right now. Mary needs help. Do you understand? Mary needs help." "What are you talk—" "She got out. She's running down the road toward town, and Tack is chasing her. You have to go now. Right now." Ralph reached for him again, but this time in a tentative, strengthless way. David ducked easily beneath his arm and jumped from the Ryder truck's tailgate into the street. "David!" Cynthia cried. "Splitting up like this! Are you sure it's right?" "No," he shouted back. He felt desperate and confused and more than a little stunned. "I know how wrong it feels. It feels wrong to me, too, but there's nothing else. I swear to you, there's just nothing else." "You get back in here," Ralph bawled. David turned, dark eyes meeting his father's frantic gaze. "Go, Dad, all three of you, now, you have to. Help her. For God's sake, help Mary!" And before anyone could ask another question, David Carver turned on his heel and went pelting off into the dark. With one hand, he pumped the air. The other he held against the front of his shirt. cupping John Edward Merrinville's genuine crocodile wallet. $395. Barney's of New York. 5. Ralph tried to jump out after his son. Steve grabbed him by the shoulders, and Cynthia grabbed him around the waist. "Let me go!" Ralph shouted, struggling. But not struggling too hard at that. Steve felt marginally encouraged. "Let me go after my son!" "No," Cynthia said. "We have to believe he knows what he's doing, Ralph."
"I can't lose him, too," Ralph whispered.
But he relaxed, quit trying to pull away from them.
"I can't."
"Maybe the best way to make sure that doesn't happen is to go along with what he wants," Cynthia said. Ralph drew a deep breath, then exhaled it. "My son went after that asshole," he said. He sounded as if he were talking to himself, explaining to himself. "He went after that conceited asshole to give him back his wallet. And if we asked him why, he'd say, 'Because it's God's will.' Am I right?"
"Yeah, probably," Cynthia said. She reached out and touched Ralph's shoulder. He opened his eyes and she smiled at him. "And you know the bitch of it? It's probably the truth."
Ralph looked at Steve. "You wouldn't leave him, would you? Pick up Mary, take that equipment road back to the highway, and leave my boy behind?" Steve shook his head. Ralph put his hands to his face, seemed to gather himself, dropped his hands, and stared at them. There was a stony cast to his features now, a look of resolves taken and bridges burned. A queer thought came to Steve. For the first time since he'd met the Carvers, he could see the son in the father.
"All right," Ralph said. "We'll leave God to protect my kid until we get back." He jumped off the back of the truck and looked grimly down the street. "It'll have to be God. That bastard Merrinville sure won't do it."
Chapter 4 1 The thought which flashed across Johnny's mind as the wolf charged him was the kid saying that the creature running this show wanted them to leave town, would be happy to let them go. Maybe it was a little glitch in the kid's second sight. Or maybe Tack had just seen a chance to pick one of them off and was taking it. Never look a gift horse in the mouth, and all that. In either case, he thought, I am royally fucked. "You deserve to be, sweetheart," Terry said from behind him. Yeah, that was Terry, all right, helpful to the end. He brandished the hammer at the oncoming wolf and yelled, "Get out of here!" in a shrill voice he barely recognized as his own. The wolf broke left and turned in a tight circle, growling as it went, hindquarters low to the ground, tail tucked. One of its powerful shoulders struck a cabinet as it completed its turn, and a teacup balanced on top of it fell off and shattered on the floor. The radio coughed out a long, loud bray of static. Johnny took one step toward the door, visualizing how he would pelt down the hall and out into the parking lot. Fuck the ATV, he'd find wheels elsewhere. And then the wolf was in the aisle again, head down and hackles up, eyes horribly intelligent, horribly aware eyes, glowing. Johnny retreated, holding the hammer up in front of him like a knight saluting the king with his sword, waggling it slightly. He could feel his palm sweating against the hammer's perforated rubber sleeve. The wolf looked huge, the size of a full-grown German shepherd at least. By comparison, the hammer looked ridiculously small, the kind of pantry cabinet accessory one kept around for repairing shelves or installing picture hooks. "God help me," Johnny said, but he felt no presence here. God was just something you said, a word you used when you could see the shit once more getting ready to obey the law of gravity and fall into the fan. No God. No God. He wasn't a suburban kid from Ohio, still 3 years away from his first encounter with a razor. Prayer was just a manifestation of what the psychologists called magical thinking, and there was no God. If there was,
Why would he come see about me, anyhow? Why would he come see about me after I left the others back in that truck? The wolf suddenly barked at him. It was an absurd sound, high-pitched, the kind of bark Johnny would have expected from a poodle or a cocker spaniel. There was nothing absurd about its teeth, though. Thick curds of spit flew out from between them with each high-pitched bark.
"Get out!" Johnny yelled at it in his shrill, wavering voice. "Get out right now!"
Instead of getting out, the wolf screwed its hindquarters down toward the floor. For a moment, Johnny thought it was going to take a crap, that it was every damn bit as scared as he was, and it was going to take a crap on the laboratory floor. Then, a split second before it happened, he realized the wolf was preparing not to crap, but to leap at him.
"No, God, no, please!"
he screamed and turned to run, back toward the ATV and the bodies hanging stiffly on their hooks. In his head he did this. His body moved in the opposite direction, forward, as if directed by hands he could not see. There was no sense of being possessed, but a clear and unmistakable feeling of being no longer alone. His terror fell away. His first powerful instinct, to turn and run, also fell away. He took a step forward instead, pushing off from the table with his free hand. He cocked the hammer back to beyond his right shoulder and hurled it just as the wolf launched itself at him. He expected the hammer to spin and was sure it would sail over the animal's head. He had pitched at Lincoln Park High School about 1,000 years ago and still knew the feeling of one that was going to be wild high. But it didn't. It was no Excalibur, just a plain old craftsman hammer with a perforated rubber sleeve on it to improve the grip. But it didn't turn over, and it didn't go high. What it did was strike the wolf dead center between the eyes. There was a sound like a brick dropped on an oak plank. The green glare whiffed out of the wolf's eyes. They turned into old marbles even as the blood began to pour out of the animal's center-split skull. Then it hit him in the chest, driving him back against the table again, setting off a brilliant burst of pain in the small of his back. For a moment, Johnny could smell the wolf, a dry smell, almost cinnamony, like the spices the Egyptians had used to preserve the dead. For that moment, the animal's bloody face was turned up to his, the teeth which should by all rights have torn out his throat, leering impotently. Johnny could see its tongue and an old crescent-shaped scar on its muzzle. Then it dropped on his feet, like something loose and heavy wrapped in a ratty old steamer blanket. Gasping, Johnny staggered away from it. He bent to pick up the hammer, then whirled around so clumsily he almost fell, sure that the wolf would be on its feet and coming for him again. There was no way he could have gotten it with a hammer like that. Absolutely no way. That baby had been going high. Your muscles remembered what it felt like when you'd uncorked one that was going all the way to the backstop. They remembered it very well. But the wolf lay where it had fallen. "Is it time to reconsider David Carver's God?" Terry asked quietly. Stereo Terry now. She had a place in his head, and she also had a place on the wall under, "You must wear a hard hat." "No," he said. "It was a lucky shot, that's all. Like the 1 in 1,000 at the carny where you actually do win your girlfriend, the big stuffed panda bear." "Thought you said it was going high." "Well, I was wrong, wasn't I? Just like you used to tell me 6 or 12 times every fucking day, you great bitch." He was shocked by the hoarse, almost teary quality of his voice. "Wasn't that pretty much your refrain throughout the course of our charming union? You're wrong, Johnny. You're wrong, Johnny. You're totally fucking wrong, Johnny." "You left them," Terry's voice said, and what stopped him was not the contempt he heard in that voice, which was, after all, only his own voice, his own mind, up to its old bicameral tricks, but the despair. "You left them to die. Worse, you continued to deny God even after you called on him, and he answered. What kind of man are you?" A man who knows the difference between God and a free throw, he told the woman with the strawberry blonde hair and the bullet hole in her lab coat. A man who also knows enough to get while the getting's good. He waited for Terry to respond. Terry didn't. He considered what had just happened a final time, scanning it with his nearly perfect recall, and found nothing but his own arm, which apparently hadn't forgotten everything it had learned about throwing a fastball, and an ordinary craftsman hammer. No blue light. No Cecil B. DeMille special effects. No London Philharmonic swelling with 100 violins worth of phony awe in the background. The terror and emptiness and despair he felt were transitory emotions. They would pass. What he was going to do right now was divorce the ATV from the ore cart behind it, using the hammer to knock loose the cotter pin coupling. What he was going to do next was get the ATV running and get the hell out of this creepy little... "Not bad, Ace," said a voice from the doorway. Johnny wheeled around. The boy was standing there, David, looking at the wolf. Then he raised his unsmiling face to Johnny. "A lucky shot," Johnny said. "Think that was it? Does your father know you're out, David?"
"He knows."
"If you came here to try and persuade me to stay, you're shit out of luck," Johnny said. He bent over the coupling between the ore cart and the ATV and took a swing at the cotter pin. He missed it completely and smashed his hand painfully against an angle of metal. He cried out and stuck his scraped knuckles into his mouth. Yet he had hit the leaping wolf dead between the eyes with the hammer. Johnny blocked the rest. He pulled his hand out of his mouth, tightened his grip on the hammer's rubber sleeve, and bent over the coupling again. This time he hit it pretty well. Not dead center, but close enough to pop the cotter pin free and send it rolling across the floor. It stopped beneath the dangling feet of the woman who looked like Terry. "And I'm not going to read anything into that, either." "If you came to talk theology, you're similarly out of luck," Johnny said. "If, however, you'd like to accompany me west to Austin..." He broke off. The boy now had something in his hand, was holding it out to him. Between them, the dead wolf lay on the lab floor. "What's that?" Johnny asked, but he knew. His eyes weren't that bad yet. Suddenly his mouth felt very dry. "Why are you chasing me?" he thought suddenly, to what he did not precisely know, only that it wasn't the kid. "Why can't you lose my scent? Just leave me alone." "Your wallet," David said, his eyes on him, so steady. "It fell out of your pocket, in the truck. I brought it to you. It's got all your ID in it, in case you forget who you are."
"Very funny."
"I wasn't joking." "So what do you want?" Johnny asked harshly. "A reward? Okay. Write down your address. I'll send you either $20 or an autographed book. Want a baseball signed by Albert Bell? I can do that. Whatever you want. Whatever strikes your fancy." David looked down at the wolf for a moment. Pretty good shot for a man who can't even hit a coupling dead on from 4 inches away. "Shut up, wise guy," Johnny said. "Bring me the wallet if you're coming. Toss it over if you're not. Or just keep the goddamn thing." "There's a picture in it. You and two other guys standing in front of a place called the Viet Cong Lookout. A bar, I think." "Yeah, a bar," Johnny agreed. He flexed his hand uneasily on the shaft of the hammer, barely feeling the sting run across his scraped knuckles. "The tall guy in that picture's David Halberstam, very famous writer, historian, baseball fan. I was more interested in the ordinary-sized guy in the middle," David said. And all at once a part of Johnny, a deep, deep part, knew what the child was driving at, what the child was going to say, and that part moaned in protest. "The guy in the gray shirt and the Yankees hat, the guy that showed me the China pit from my Viet Cong lookout, that guy was you."
"What crap," Johnny said. "The same kind of crazed crap you've been spouting ever since..."
Softly, perfectly on key, and still holding the wallet out to him on one hand, David Carver sang, "Well, I said doctor, Mr. M.D." It was like being slugged square in the middle of the chest. The hammer spilled out of Johnny's hand. "Stop it," he whispered. "Can you tell me what's ailing me?" And he said, "Yeah, yeah, 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 yeah." "Stop it," Johnny screamed, and the radio burped up another burst of static. He could feel stuff starting to move inside him. Terrible stuff. Sliding. Like an avalanche beginning under a surface that only looks solid. Why did the boy have to come? Because he was sent, of course. It wasn't David's fault. The real question was why couldn't the boy's terrible master let either of them go? "The rascals," David said. Only back then they were still the young rascals. Felix Cavalieri on vocals. Very cool. That's the song that was playing when you died, wasn't it, Johnny? Images beginning to slide downhill through his mind while Felix Cavalieri sang, "I was feeling so bad." Arvin soldiers, many no bigger than American sixth graders, pulling dead buttocks apart, looking for hidden treasure. A nasty scavenger hunt in a nasty war. Can-ta in can-tack. Coming back to Terry with a dose in his crotch and a monkey on his back, wanting to score so bad he was half out of his mind, slapping her in an airport concourse when she said something smart about the war. His war, she had called it, as if he had invented the fucking thing. Slapping her so hard that her mouth and nose bled, and although the marriage had limped along for another year or so, it had really ended right there in Concourse B of the United Terminal at LaGuardia, with the sound of that slap. And Trajan kicking him as he lay writhing on Highway 50, not kicking a literary lion or a National Book Award winner or the only white male writer in America who mattered, but just some pot-bellied geezer in an overpriced motorcycle jacket, one who owed God a death like anyone else, and Trajan saying that the proposed title of Johnny's book made him furious, made him sick with rage. "I won't go back there," Johnny said hoarsely. "Not for you, not for Steve Ames or your father, not for Mary, not for the world. I won't." He picked up the hammer again and slammed it against the ore cart, punctuating his refusal. "Do you hear me, David? You're wasting your time. I won't go back. Won't, won't, won't." "At first, I didn't understand how it could have been you," David said, as if he hadn't heard. "It was the land of the dead. You even said so, Johnny. But you were alive. That's what I thought, at least. Even when I saw the scar." He pointed to Johnny's wrist. "You died... when? 1966? 1968? I guess it doesn't matter. When a person stops changing, stops feeling, they die. The times you've tried to kill yourself since, you were just playing catch-up, weren't you?" And the child smiled at him with a sympathy that was unspeakable in its innocence and kindness and lack of judgment. "Johnny," David Carver said, "God can raise the dead." "Oh, Jesus, don't tell me that," he whispered. "I don't want to be raised." But his voice seemed to reach him from far away, and curiously doubled, as if he were coming apart in some strange but fundamental way, fracturing like Hornfels. "It's too late," David said. "It's already happened." "Fuck you, little hero. I'm going to Austin. Do you hear me? Fucking Austin." "Tack will be there ahead of you," David said. He was still holding out the wallet, the one with the picture of Johnny and David Halberstam and Duffy Panette standing outside that sleazy little bar, the Viet Cong Lookout. A dive, but it had had the best jukebox in the Nam. A Wurlitzer. In his head, Johnny could taste Kirin beer and hear the rascals, the drive of the drums, the organ like a dagger, and how hot it had been, how green and how hot.
the sun like thunder, the earth smelling like pussy every time it rained, and that song had seemed to come from everywhere, every club, every radio, every shithole juke. In a way, that song was Vietnam. I was feeling so bad, I asked my family doctor just what I had. That's the song that was playing when you died, wasn't it, Johnny?
Austin,
he whispered in a feeble, failing voice. And still there was that sense of twinning, that sense of two-ness. If you leave now, Tack will be waiting for you in a lot of places, David said, his implacable would-be jailer still holding out his wallet, the one in which that hateful picture was entombed. Not just Austin. Hotel rooms, speaking halls, fancy lunches where people talk about books and things. When you're with a woman, it'll be you who undresses her, and Tack who has sex with her. And the worst thing is that you may live like that for a long time. Candy Latch is what you'll be, heart of the unformed. Me him can any, the empty well of the eye. I won't, he tried to scream again. But this time, no voice came out, and when he struck at the ore cart again, the hammer dropped free of his fingers. The strength left his hand. His thighs turned watery, and his knees began to unhinge. He slipped onto them with a choked and drowning cry. That sense of doubling, of twinning, was even stronger now, and he understood with both dismay and resignation that it was a true sensation. He was literally dividing himself in two. There was John Edward Merrinville, who didn't believe in God and didn't want God to believe in him. That creature wanted to go and understood that Austin would only be the first stop. And there was Johnny, who wanted to stay. More, who wanted to fight. Who had progressed far enough into this mad supernaturalism to want to die in David's God, to burn his brain in it, and go out like a moth in the chimney of a kerosene lamp. Suicide, his heart cried out. Suicide, suicide. Arvin soldiers, war's dead-eyed optimists, looking for diamonds in assholes. A drunk with a bottle of beer in his hand and his wet hair in his eyes, climbing out of a hotel swimming pool, laughing as the cameras flashed. Terry's nose bleeding below her hurt, incredulous eyes, while a voice from the sky announced that United's flight 507 to Jacksonville was boarding at gate B7. The cop kicking him as he writhed on the center line of a desert highway. It makes me furious, the cop had said. It makes me sick with rage. Johnny felt himself leave his own body, felt himself grasped by hands that were not his own, and turned out of his flesh like change from a pocket. He stood ghost-like beside the kneeling man, and saw the kneeling man holding his hands out. "I'll take it," the kneeling man said. He was weeping. "I'll take my wallet. What the fuck? Give it back." He saw the boy come to the kneeling man and kneel beside him. He saw the kneeling man take the wallet and then put it in the front pocket of the jeans beneath the chaps so he could press his hands together, finger to finger, as David had done. "What do I say?" the kneeling man asked, weeping. "Oh, David, how do I start? What do I say?" "What's in your heart?" the kneeling boy said, and that was when the ghost gave up and rejoined the man. Clarity streaked into the world, lighting it up, lighting him up, like napalm, and he heard Felix Cavalieri singing, "I said, baby, it's for sure. I got the fever, you got the cure." "Help me, God," Johnny said, raising his hands to a place where they were even with his eyes, and he could see them well. "Oh, God, please help me. Help me do what I was sent here to do. Help me to be whole. Help me to live. God, help me to live again." Two. "I'm going to catch you, bitch," it thought triumphantly,
At first, chances of that had seemed slim. It had gotten within 20 yards of the Ozpah near the top of the pit, 60 short feet, but the bitch had been able to find a little extra and beat it to the top. Once she started down the other side, Mary had been able to extend her lead in a hurry, from 20 yards to 60 to 150, because she could breathe deeply. She could cope with her body's oxygen debt. Ellen Carver's body, on the other hand, was rapidly losing the ability to do either. The vaginal bleeding had become a flood, something that would kill the Ellen body in the next 20 minutes or so anyway. But if Tack was able to catch Mary, it wouldn't matter how much the remains of Ellen Carver bled. It would have a place to go. But as it came over the rim of the pit, something had ruptured in Ellen's left lung as well. Now, with every exhale, it was not just spraying a fine mist of red, but shooting out liquid jets of blood and tissue from both Ellen's mouth and nose. And it couldn't get enough fresh oxygen to keep up the chase, not with just one working lung. Then, a miracle. Running too fast for the grade and trying to look back over her shoulder at the same time, the bitch's feet tangled together and she took a spectacular tumble, hitting the gravel surface of the road in a kind of swan dive and plowing downhill for almost 10 feet before she came to a stop, leaving a dark drag mark behind her. She lay face down with her arms extended, trembling all over. In the starlight, her splayed hands looked like pale creatures fished out of a tide pool. Tack saw her trying to get a knee under her. It came partway up, then relaxed and slid back again.
Now! Now! Tack Awan!
Tack forced the Ellen body into a semblance of a run, gambling on the last of that body's energy, gambling on its own agility to keep from tripping and falling as the bitch had done. The back and forth of its respiration had become a kind of wet chugging in Ellen's throat, like a piston running in thick grease. Ellen's sensory equipment was graying out at the edges, getting ready to shut down. But she would last a little longer. Just a little. And a little was all it would take. 140 yards. 120. Tack ran at the woman lying in the road, screaming in soundless, hungry triumph as it closed the gap. 3. Mary could hear something coming, something that was yelling nonsense words in a thick, gargly voice. Could hear the thud of shoes on the gravel, closing in. But it all seemed unimportant, like things heard in a dream. And surely this had to be a dream, didn't it? Get up, Mary. You have to get up. She looked around and saw something awful, but not in the least dreamlike, bearing down on her. Its hair flew out behind it. One of its eyes had ruptured. Blood exploded from its mouth with each breath. And on its face was the look of a starving animal, abandoning the stalk and staking everything on one last charge. Get up, Mary, get up! I can't. I'm scraped all over and it's too late anyway, she moaned to the voice. But even as she was moaning, she was struggling with her knee again, trying to cock it under her. This time she managed the trick and struggled upward with the knee as her center, trying to pull herself out of gravity's well this one last time. The Ellen thing was in full sprint now. It seemed to be exploding out of its clothes as it came, and it was screaming, a drawn-out howl of rage and hunger packed in blood. Mary got on her feet, screaming herself now as the thing swooped down, reaching out, grasping for her with its fingers. She threw herself into a full downhill run, eyes bulging, mouth sprung open in a full-jawed but silent scream. A hand, sickeningly hot, slapped down between her shoulder blades and tried to twist itself into her shirt. Mary hunched forward and almost fell as her upper body swayed out beyond the point of balance, but the hand slipped away.
Bitch!
An inhuman, guttural growl from right behind her. And this time the hand closed in her hair. It might have held if the hair had been dry, but it was slick, almost slimy, with sweat. For a moment she felt the thing's fingers on the back of her neck, and then they were gone. She ran down the slope in lengthening leaps, her fear now mingling with a kind of crazy exhilaration. There was a thud from behind her. She risked a look back and saw that the Ellen thing had gone down. It lay curled in on itself like a crushed snail. Its hands opened and closed on thin air, as if still searching for the woman who had barely managed to elude it. Mary turned and focused on the blinker light. It was closer now. And there were other lights as well. She was sure of it. Headlights, and coming this way. She focused on them, ran toward them. She never even registered the large shape which passed silently above her. 4. All over. It had come so close, had actually touched the bitch's hair. But at the last second, Mary had eluded it. And even as she began to draw away again, Ellen's feet had crossed and Tack went down, listening to the rupturing sounds from inside the Ellen body as it rolled onto its side, grasping at the air as if it might find handholds in it. It rolled over onto Ellen's back, staring up at the star-filled sky, moaning with pain and hate. To have come so close. That was when it saw the dark shape up there, blotting out the stars in a kind of gliding crucifix, and felt a sudden fresh burst of hope. It had thought of the wolf and then dismissed the idea because the wolf was too far away. But it had been wrong to believe the wolf was the only canned toy vessel which might hold Tack for a little while. There was this.
"Me him," it whispered in its dying, blood-thick voice. "Candy latch. Me him. Minento. Tack.
Come to me. Come to Tack. Come to the old one. Come to the heart of the unformed. Come to me, vessel." It held up Ellen's dying arms, and the golden eagle fluttered down into them, staring into Tack's dying face with rapt eyes. 5. "Don't look at the bodies," Johnny said. He was rolling the ore cart away from the ATV. David was helping. "I'm not, believe me," David said. "I've seen enough bodies to last me a lifetime." "I think that's good enough." Johnny started toward the driver's side of the ATV and tripped over something. David grabbed his arm, although he, Johnny, hadn't come especially close to falling. "Watch it, Gramps." "You got a mouth on you, kid." It was the hammer he'd tripped on. He picked it up, turned to toss it back onto the work table, then reconsidered and stuck the rubber-sleeved handle into the belt of his chaps. The chaps now had enough blood and dirt grimed into them to look almost like the real thing, and the hammer felt right there, somehow. There was a control box set to the right of the metal door. Johnny pushed the blue button marked up, mentally prepared for more problems, but the door rattled smoothly along its track. The air that came in, smelling faintly of Indian paintbrush and sage, was fresh and sweet, like heaven. David filled his chest with it, turned to Johnny, and smiled. "Nice." "Yeah, come on, hop in this beauty, take you for a spin." David climbed into the front passenger seat of the vehicle, which looked like a high-slung, oversized golf cart. Johnny turned the key and the engine caught at once. As he ran it out through the open door, it occurred to him that none of this was happening. It was all just part of an idea he'd had for a new novel, a fantasy tale. Perhaps even an outright horror novel. Something of a departure for John Edward Merrinville either way. Not the sort of stuff of which serious literature was made, but so what? He was getting on, and if he wanted to take himself a little less seriously, surely he had that right. There was no need to shoulder each book like a backpack filled with rocks and then sprint uphill with it. That might be okay for the kids, the boot camp recruits, but those days were behind him now.
and it was sort of a relief that they were. Not real. None of this. Nah.